This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, James Murphy, is the leader of the band LCD Sound System, a band which sometimes is really just Murphy in his studio using instruments, electronics, and overdubbing. LCD Sound System plays dance music, and Murphy used to be a club DJ, but the lyrics of his songs are often ironic and funny, and the music that inspires him goes way beyond dance music. He's been embraced by indie rock fans who are not known for their dancing. LCD Sound System's 2007 album, Sound of Silver, was voted number one in the Village Voice Paz and Jop Music Critics poll and was on NPR's list of the top albums of the decade. The band has a new album called This Is Happening, which Murphy says will be his final album under that name. Let's hear the track Drunk Girls, co-written by Murphy and featuring him on vocals, drums, synthesizers, guitar, bass, Wurlitzer, tambourine, and hand claps. That's Drunk Girls from LCD Sound System's new album, This Is Happening. My guest is James Murphy, who is not only the founder of the band, he is most of the band. James Murphy, welcome to Fresh Air. So in a recent article about you in The New Yorker, you said that LCD Sound System is set up to be an argument about what's wrong with bands and why they should be better. I would like you to explain what you mean by that.
Well, I'm a by nature, to a certain degree, I feel like I'm a healthy or unhealthy, depending on your perspective, combination of optimist and curmudgeon. And I would go to shows, and I've seen a lot of really what I thought to be great bands, great live bands in my life. And when I would start going to see shows and see bands kind of prioritize things wrong, to my mind, like not prioritize the momentness of a show, or not prioritize the physical experience of a show, instead prioritize making sure they don't make mistakes, or prioritize trying to faithfully represent a pre-recorded piece of material. I felt like that was just a wrong. And when I hit my early 30s, I decided to do something which to my mind was radical, which was to stop complaining about things, which I did wonderfully. I was a very good complainer. I could go after a show and sit outside and on the steps with a beer with a friend and just complain endlessly. And I decided that was not a healthy way of life. And instead, I should make an argument with actually doing things, because it seemed like that would knock some of the silliness out of my argument. So we started to make a band that was just about, like, well, I don't like the way these types of sounds sound at shows. I'm going to try to change that. Or I don't like it when I see someone with an in-ear monitor that's not experiencing the actual entirety of the band. They have a separate mix for their head, and I feel like it changes the way you play. So we're not going to do that. You know, just creating, you know, little arguments about what being a band is.
You worked as a DJ for how long?
I guess I started DJing I started DJing for, you know, no money when I was 29. And around the same time as starting I have a label called DFA Records in New York. So DFA was a party, and I started DJing just at my own party. And I didn't do it at other places. Nobody hired me. I hired myself. And around 29, around the same time as starting the band, loosely.
So how did DJing at your own parties contribute to your approach as a composer? Because certainly when you're DJing, you're looking for a groove also.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think after being in, you know, like selfish, I don't mean self-important in a really particularly derogatory way, but like self-involved punk bands my whole life, you're thinking about what is it you want to make? Who is it you want to be? But DJing and finding dance music was much more about, it was a much more of a communication device. It was like very blatant. It's like, if people aren't dancing, you're not doing a good job. You can't make any other argument about it. There's something simple and workmanly about it that I really liked. And it changed making music for me, because suddenly I wanted to make music. I wanted to make songs after having given up. I'd stopped being in bands when I was 26, so took 3 years off, and I wanted to do it again, because suddenly there was an actual quantifiable way of measuring if you were doing your job. People danced or they didn't. And if they did, you know, you're doing your job. And if you like it and they did, then you're doing your job in an uncompromised way, which was a really nice thing to finally be able to learn.
So the band is called LCD Sound System, and you used mm-hmm. to create sound systems.
Yes.
And your record label was called, or is still called, what's called?
Yeah,
it's
DFA,
called DFA,
DFA Records,
which stands for
is, yeah.
Death From Above, which is also what
yes.
you called your sound system, because it was all about loud.
Yes,
really
loud.
And why does really loud appeal to you, and how loud are we talking?
Okay. Now, and this is another thing that I'm pretty specific about and pretty, very strong feelings about. I don't like hurting ears. I don't like hurting people's ears. I don't like hurting my own ears. And there are frequencies that I find that I'm hypersensitized to, and I think they're, people normally are. The human voice likes to hover around 1,000 hertz. That's sort of like the center of our hearing. And, you know, you can go up to 20,000 and go down to 20 hertz. And, you know, that's kind of the range of human ring. That's kind of the area where we listen in. So I like to make sure we're not punishing anybody in these frequencies that hurt your ears. But I do like the visceral physical experience of bass when it's attached to the rest of the sounds. I think it's bodily. The first shows I saw were really bodily loud. It was a really incredible experience for me. Like your adrenaline goes up. You kind of have a fight or flight experience that can be maintained in a nice way by volume. And I think like a certain type of airy treble, a certain type of airy space that doesn't hurt your ears again, is kind of wonderful and magical and for lack of a less hackneyed and overused term, psychedelic. Volume is a big part of that. I think a lot of people have lost the art of using volume in a way that isn't just harsh and painful. But it's something that I'm really into. Like our band is on stage is typically illegally loud in a lot of countries. Like in France, I think you can't be above 97 dB, and where I stand on stage can be about 120 decibels.
And you don't think you're hurting your ears?
I still test better than average. I still test really high frequency. It can be fatiguing. You know, we shouldn't do more than 5 shows in a row. And we used to do shows that were about an hour, and now they're about an hour and 40 minutes. So, you know, we've knocked this where I stand down to about 114, 115 decibels. If it doesn't feel right physically, I would just be thinking constantly on stage. I would just be constantly thinking. And then I'd forget the lyrics and I'd forget the arrangements and it wouldn't be a very good show.
You'd be thinking, oh, it's not loud enough, or?
I would just be thinking. I'd just turn my brain back on. I need the,
oh, I see,
for me,
so
I need a certain amount of volume to turn the brain off.
Right.
Turn the rattling monkey in my head off.
I'm glad you say you're not interested in hurting people's ears. There was just like one concert that I went to in a small venue where it was so loud, so intentionally loud, that I moved way back because I thought like, this is really egotistical on the performer's part. If he thinks his music is worth damaging my hearing, he's crazy.
I think it's also, the band is typically mixed by an engineer too. So it's kind of a combo of who's really trying to hurt you.
Oh,
and
I think he was.
Designed by somebody.
In this case, I think he was.
And also the system's designed by somebody typically who doesn't know how to design sound systems. People, that's a lost art now because everything's pre-packaged. Like sound systems come pre-packaged now. People used to design them. I used to design boxes and design the amplifiers and the crossovers, and you could make them specific to rooms, but now they're mostly cookie cutters, and someone comes in with a mystical computer and sets it up, and then they go away, and then they get messed with a little bit every night until they sound bad again. Mm-hmm. Then they have the mystery man come in with his computer and fix it.
Right.
It's kind of, I don't know, I'm an anachronism, I would say, in that I like to control these things as much as possible in a more old-fashioned way.
Well, I thought we'd hear another LCD sound system recording, and this is from earlier. This is called Losing My Edge, and it's one of the most famous things that you've done.
It's the first one.
Yeah, yeah. And let's hear it. I think this is like a really funny song, and I'll just say it's about somebody who thinks he's losing his edge to the kids who are coming up from behind him. And so let's hear it, and then we'll talk about it. So this is LCD Sound System.
Losing my edge. I heard you have a compilation of every good song ever done by anybody. Every great song by the Beach Boys. All the underground hits, all the modern lovers tracks. I heard you have a vinyl of every Niagara record on German imports. I heard that you have a white label of every seminal Detroit techno hit, 1985, 86, 87. I heard that you have a CD compilation of every good 60s cut and another box set from the 70s. I hear you're buying a synthesizer.
So that's the first single by LCD Sound System, and my guest James Murphy is the creator of LCD Sound System. And I think that's just so funny, and when I listen to it, I can't help but wonder how much of this is about you and how much of it is older people who you met coming up through the ranks who were afraid that they were losing their edge to people like you.
It's a little bit both. It's really from a specific position and time in my life, really more than it is about it, where I had started DJing and I hadn't released any music. We had DFA Records and I started having, there was parties that I was throwing and I was DJing. And for the first time in my life, I was almost cool.
but not quite.
at like 29 years old, I had my first taste of like, wait, people want me to come, people to this party and DJ. This is very exciting for me. And then I remember I went to a punk show, and between the bands, somebody was DJing. Now, that wasn't done. And I was like, wait, that's my thing. Like, I play records, you know. And they were playing some of the records I played, and I got really upset. And I looked, and they were like 24, 23, and I was really mad. And then I started getting very embarrassed that I was getting mad, because I remembered being in a young band when I was 23 or 24 and talking to this guy who was like ancient. I think he might have been 28 or 29, you know, practically in his grave. And he was talking about how kids now, they don't know, the guitar sounds aren't good and things like that. And I remember just being like, oh man, you never say that. That's such a lame thing to say. And then I caught myself doing it and I'm like, oh, I'm saying it. But at the same time, it's true, but it's so pathetic. And it made for the easiest song I've ever written. It was the easiest song to write. The whole lyric with a couple of, I punched it in a couple of times, but I played drums and sang that song in one take, just without writing anything beforehand. The only thing that I wrote was the list of songs that I yell at the end. I mean, the list of artists that I yell at the end. The whole thing was just made up because it was such a fertile and embarrassing and circular set of feelings. Like, it was so easy to know what I was mad about and so easy to be embarrassed by it. And so, you know, it was just like endlessly like, oh, but, you know, type of emotion that I had. So it was a really, and after that I was overconfident. I was like, I can write songs all the time. This is easy. just have an experience that typifies your life at that moment, and then go yell about it.
It's funny because I kind of half imagined you taking like having this secret notebook in which you wrote down all the things that people said to you about why they were worried about younger people coming up and replacing them,
no,
why they were losing their edge, because it's also perfect.
It was so simple to me. It like seemed like such a good. And at the end, the reason I yell all the band names was I suddenly realized it's like, you know, I'm one of these. I suddenly realized I was like, this is what you do when you know things. Knowing things, knowledge, or like your attachment to them, or your self-association with other bands, or with books, or whatever, is usually like this. Often this weird amulet that protects you. Like you're like, no, I am serious. Look at my library. Listen to this. Like I'm going to list all the books I've read. And now you know I'm a serious person. And so it was just supposed to be like this amulet swinging around me to protect me from being seen as anything that I didn't want to be seen as.
Yeah, I think a lot of people have experienced that. You know, what you read, what you listen to as who you are.
Yes.
I think my favorite line in Losing My Edge is, I hear you've done a compilation of every good song ever done by anybody. That's really great.
It just, yeah, it's which is, you know, of course, now that's just the internet, isn't it?
Well, yeah, but that's not any one single person.
Exactly.
Yeah. And then you say, I've never been wrong. I used to work in a record store.
No, you had everything before anyone.
Yeah. So did you used to work in a record store?
I actually didn't. That's the only typical rock nerd job I did not have. Uh-huh. I had every other typical rock nerd job. At the time when I could have worked in a record store, it was very hard to get those jobs because they were the most desirable. So I worked in a bookstore instead, which was the second most desirable job.
But you probably frequented record stores a lot.
Oh, boy, yeah. Yeah, I basically lived in them.
So let's play another track from your new CD, This Is Happening. And I thought we'd play something that's kind of different in tone from what we just heard. And this is called Home. And it's more emotional. And I thought we'd quote a couple of lines from it and see how this connects to your life, if at all, if this song grew out of your life or is just a song. So the lines are, so grab your things and stumble into the night so we can shut the door on terrible times. And then a little later you say, this is the trick. Forget a terrible year so we can break the laws until it gets weird. So did you write this after a terrible year?
Yeah, it was a pretty bad year last year for a lot of my friends. A very, very close friend of ours passed away. Somebody that a lot of people were very, very close to, like genuinely big part of the music scene in New York and separate from the music scene, just a very good friend named Jerry Fuchs, who's a drummer who'd played in LCD, he'd played in the Juan McLean and Holy Ghost. He played in like a ton of bands that we were all involved with. And I've known him for a really long time. So it kind of just took a big bite out of everybody in New York. And it was it was sort of like an unfortunate mark on that year. So that year, 2009, kind of is kind of always to me that year.
Okay, so why don't we hear Home? And this is LCD Sound System. My guest is James Murphy, who's the founder of the band, and the band is more or less him. So here it is. This is Home. CD, This Is Happening. My guest, James Murphy, is the founder of the band, and the band is kind of him with other people helping out.
Yeah, it depends on how it's divided. It's a very hard one. It's definitely a band. Like, we're on tour. There's six or seven of us, depending on the song. And we are really a band. But in the studio, I think, and I do work with some people in the band in the studio, but I've come up with, the best description I've come up with is if the band was a movie, I'd be the director, like the writer-director, but I work very closely with, like, it'd be like if Martin Scorsese had, you know, Robert De Niro, like Robert would be involved with the writing, and, you know, like it'd be like, you'd be involved in a deep, right. in a deeper way than just like being cast and given the script. So we do all work together, but it's like, I think in the end, the responsibility of dealing with it winds up being mine.
You have these really, even in a more emotional song like Home, you have these really catchy grooves. And I'm wondering if that's, if your composing revolves around finding the groove first.
A lot of times it does. I'm not a big songwriter guy. People that were really good singer-songwriters, that usually left me kind of cold. I've always been more of a physical music person. Even when I didn't listen to dance music, I didn't quite realize it. But like the punk bands I liked, I had like a physicality that I really liked. Lyrically and vocally, I was never all that interested in melody or great voices. And musically, I was never that interested in chord changes. I always just liked to find something that kind of did one thing for a really long time and did it very well. Or just had a physicalness to it that I really liked.
So rhythm kind of becomes melody for you.
Yeah, to a certain degree. Just repetition and rhythm, yeah.
So the tracks on the new CD are approximately under 8 minutes each.
Yeah.
And you know, on the dance floor, people tend to play long tracks. But
yes.
What is it, does about 8 minutes seem like the right amount for like a listening experience?
I don't know. I'm always wrong about these things. Like, you know, whenever I listen to a record growing up and somebody would, I'd be like, oh, this is the hit. And then, of course, I'd be completely wrong.
Yeah.
So I don't have the ear for that. I know for me, I like, you know, for me, a pop song's about 5 minutes 40.
Oh, you got it down exactly.
Yeah, like, no, I kept noticing. I'm like, oh, the pop song on this record. It's like, well, it's like 5.5 minutes. We still have to cut 2 minutes off of it to put it, make a radio single out of it. It's like, oh. And this record doesn't, although Drunk Girls is almost 3.5 minutes. It's under 4 minutes, which is a real shocker for me. The only songs I ever write that are under 4 minutes are just like kind of barnstorming punk songs. But for me, I think like a pop song is like 5 minutes long because I like intros and outros. I like to let things develop before you start putting melodies on them.
Yeah, you sometimes have long instrumental sections before the vocal starts.
Yeah, I like that. I mean, I like when we play live, it's nice for me because I can like let things settle. I can make sure I can hear everything the way I want to, and then we can then start singing. I find it more fun. I always have, though. I've always liked these kind of things that just go on for a while. I loved the Talking Heads because they would have these sort of mesmerizing kind of like hypnotic things. I always loved Tomorrow Never Knows by the Beatles because of how you could listen to the intro before the vocals come in for an hour. It's just kind of, it's hypnotizing. I like that. It gives me, I'm a self-conscious person, I think. I'm a shy person and a self-conscious person. And things being hypnotizing a little bit, I think, is healthy for me. It lets me, like, let my guard down and try and just sing the song or whatever. Hmm. Rather than be like, are they looking at me? Are they looking at me?
Do you
this is what I would otherwise do.
Because you know people are looking at you when you're on stage. That's one thing you
of
can
course.
Be sure of.
It's the worst, yeah. I think it's very funny when people discover that when you watch a show from the audience, you never think of that. And so someone will jump on the stage and, you know, want to dance around, and they suddenly jump there and you see that look pass over their face that they've stepped through the television and it's not what they thought. And they turn around and everyone's staring at them and they get very self-conscious, and then they kind of do a little dance that makes them look really shy, and then they jump back down. It's a pretty funny experience. And when that happens, I'm in the back of my mind, I'm like, you didn't think it was going to be like this. I know you didn't. But it's really strange up here.
So you've mentioned several times that you like really physical music. You like to feel it in your body. So I guess it's no surprise that your first instrument was drums.
My first instrument was guitar.
Oh, so it is a surprise.
It is. Well, yeah, no. I was a singer guitar player as a kid, a.k.a. I was a self-important, pretentious jerk as a kid. And controlling, you know, teenager. I started playing guitar when I started my first band when I was 12. I was in a new wave band I like to date myself by saying I was in a new wave band when it wasn't ironic. It was actually called New Wave because it was new. And so 12, 13, all through high school, I played guitar. And I moved to New York when I was 19 and started feeling like maybe the guitar wasn't for me. I met a guy who was a really great guitar player. He was a natural guitar player. This guy named Yotaka Yokoyama, who was a violinist, who picked up guitar, and we liked a lot of the same music. We played together, and watching him play guitar made me realize that maybe I'm not playing the right instrument for me, because he was just so natural and physical. And I was always trying to struggle to get the guitar to give me more of something. And then I started playing drums, and I was like, "Oh, these are great! You hit them harder, and they get louder. This all really makes sense." And so I started being a drummer in bands. I think now I've settled on that the instrument is most appropriate for me is the bass guitar, because it's somewhere between the two. It's like the workhorse, and you can play it very physically, and it delivers a lot more like punch in the stomach. But it also can drive the song around. It's a rhythmic instrument, but it's also a melodic instrument, or at least a tonal instrument.
And speaking of like physicality, you studied kickboxing after high school, which is certainly was that just because you liked physical things, or did you need to defend yourself?
No, I didn't need to defend myself. I was a very big young kid. When I was like 15, I was about 6 feet, 210 pounds. So I was fine. I just think I did it because my friend did it, and it was at the local mall, and I didn't go to college after high school. So my parents were like, "What are you doing with yourself?" So I worked in a bookstore and I kickboxed, basically having this very late 80s kind of rebellion. I finally did go to college after a year and a half of kickboxing and working in bookstores. Which was probably the best thing for me, because it wasn't that great living at my parents' house, kickboxing, and going working at a bookstore. You'd think it would be great, but it wasn't. And I decided I did want to move. I moved to New York and started playing more music and quit kickboxing. But I did love it. I really do. I do. I still love it. I train Brazilian jiu-jitsu now, which is a different kind of fighting art. But I really do. It never left me. I really do enjoy it.
Have you ever needed to use martial arts?
No. I mean, I think usually, with a couple of exceptions, usually you don't have to do any. You don't have to defend yourself. You can just walk away or say something. I've learned to not be as antagonistic as I was as a kid. I got in fights a ton when I was a kid, but that's because I was the weird kid and a loudmouth.
I want to play another song, and this is also an earlier LCD Sound System track, and it's the title track of your album, Sound of Silver. And I just think the lyrics are really interesting about being nostalgic for being a teenager until you remember what it was really like to be a teenager. So why don't we hear it, and then we'll talk about it.
Sound of Silver, talk to me, makes you want to feel like a teenager until you remember the feelings of a real live emotional teenager. Then you think again. Sound of Silver, talk to me, makes you want to feel like a teenager until you remember the feelings of a real live emotional teenager. Then you think again. Sound of Silver, talk to me, makes you want to feel like a teenager until you remember the feelings of a real live emotional teenager. Then you think again. Sound of Silver, talk to me, makes you want to feel like a teenager until you remember the feelings of a real live emotional teenager. Then you think again. Sound of Silver, talk to me, makes you want to feel like a teenager until you remember the feelings of a real life emotional teenager. Then you think again.
That's LCD Sound System. My guest is James Murphy, who's the creator of the band and plays most of the instruments on the records and does the vocals and writes the songs. So is this a kind of personal song for you?
Yeah, but in more ways than one, possibly. The type of singing is the most personal and embarrassing part of that song. I was really into Heaven 17 as a kid, too, like New Wave stuff. And the singing's kind of like arch. And people don't really sing like that anymore, kind of like this kind of like 80s new romantic baritone. And I really love it. And I've been on a quest for this almost the length of this band to just trust my taste even when it's pretty embarrassing. Because embarrassment's kind of an all right, untapped rock emotion. Usually people don't get too into embarrassment. They get into heartbreak and cool, but they don't get too much into just being embarrassing. So yeah, I just wanted to belt it out in this kind of weird way. And it was pretty funny to make those lyrics because I was like, oh, I don't really need any more lyrics. It's just a one line song, really.
And what was your real live emotional life as a teenager?
I led a pretty okay school time. I was just I kind of made things difficult for myself. Like when I was younger, I fit in a lot better. I was an athletic kid and I was a pretty big kid. But then when we got about 13, you know, certain types of I had much older brothers and sisters, and certain types of like hyper self-aware stuff happened to me pretty young. My voice changed when I was in fourth grade. I was 10. I looked bigger, you know, and something happened where I was not kind of on the same page as a lot of my peers. And watching the cruelty develop around 12, 13 was super psychically like traumatic for me. Of course, now it's like, oh yeah, people are kind of crappy to each other sometimes. You can live with that. It's okay. I also learned that people are capable of great insensitivity and horror, and also capable of, you know, great optimism and kindness. And it's a lot of times it's how you treat them that they can, you know, become the best parts of themselves or the worst parts of themselves. But at the time I had no experience of this. So watching suddenly two friends that were best friends the year before turn into cliques, and you know, the more popular of those two would be taunting the less popular of his ex-best friend, and just it all that stuff was just like, you know, I felt like I was in some sort of horrifying, you know, psychedelic nightmare that I couldn't wake up from. And it really, really traumatized me in a way that I find kind of embarrassing, because of course it's all just predictable stuff that everybody goes through. But I think you're supposed to be I think the blessing is at that age you're pretty oblivious to a lot of it, and so wrapped up in it that you don't, you know, like you're kind of missing the horror. And I didn't have that luxury, and it was not nice to watch.
So you've said that the current CD, This Is Happening, might be the final LCD Sound System CD. Why is that? By CD, well, I mean album.
I know. I always have a hard time. I'm an album person. It's not that it'll be the last album. What it is to me is like, it's become my whole life, which I'm very happy about. It's a wonderful life. I love being in this band. But to do a band properly does kind of mean you don't really get to do anything else. Now, I also have a record label, DFA. I'm a producer. I design equipment. I like to write. There's a lot of things I like to do that I can't really do because I'm doing this job. So I thought like three albums, a nice trilogy, a decade. I started it when I was about 30. I'm 40 now. It feels like a good time to stop being a professional band. That doesn't mean LCD will stop. It just means I'll go back to more the beginning, like doing Losing My Edge, just doing a song here and there, or being more fluid about my decision-making rather than album, videos, singles, tour, you know, like rather than this kind of professional arc of being in a band, I would like to go back to being just a person who gets to decide what he likes to do. And pursue something new once in a while, rather than just being like, I wish I could pursue something new, but it's going to take me 9 months to make the record, and then there's going to be 4 months of promotion, and then I'm going to tour for a year, which is kind of, when you put it together, that's 2 years of your life every time.
Now, your music is so much about being loud so that you can physically feel the music. Yet the first track on your new album, the vocal on it is really quiet, and then the instrumental comes on much louder, deeper into the track. But why start the album off at such a relatively low level?
Because I thought it would be funny. I like to play games, and I wanted the beginning to be very quiet, and I thought I'd mix the vocals even quiet for that beginning, so that you'd naturally turn up the stereo.
Uh huh.
So that the impact of when the drums and the synthesizer kick in is much stronger. Because when I would listen to it and I'd turn everything up and I'd sit there with my eyes closed and it would start and I'd play it for people who hadn't heard it before, we'd look at each other and be like, wow, it really hit. It felt really good. But then when I was, mixing it and later on, it was like losing some of that impact. And it was like, you really just have to turn it up. You really have to turn it up to get the effect. So the only way I could guarantee that people would turn it up is by recording the vocals very quietly under a quiet percussion line in the beginning, so that you'd settle into that as the median volume of the music. I mean, if you listen to classical music, people do it all the time. You start very quietly, and something dramatic happens. Not that we're making classical music. I mean, it's dumb music with drums and synthesizers, but it's just a physical thing that I like. In fact, that's why it started so quiet, so that that sense of physicality could happen.
Very clever, very devious. James Murphy, really a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. It's really nice to talk to you. It's the first time I've heard your voice and you're actually talking back to me.
Well, it's a pleasure to do it. Thank you so much. James Murphy is the founder of LCD Sound System. The band's new album is called This Is Happening. You can hear LCD Sound System's full set from this month's Bonnaroo Festival on our website, freshair.npr.org.
Present company, included in the fight.
Afrobeat has proven to be the most durable and appealing fusion of African and American pop styles. Its late creator, Fela Kuti, is the subject of a current hit Broadway show called Fela. Music critic Marlo Miles reviews new albums from Afrobeat inheritors. He says both sustain and build upon the style's foundations.
By now, a fairly wide swatch of pop music fans would know what I was talking about if I noted that in the late 1960s. Bandleader Fela Kuti invented a style called Afrobeat with the key collaboration of his drummer, Tony Allen. That I wouldn't have to explain more about who Fela Kuti was or what Afrobeat sounds like is a testament to the remarkable, accelerating rise of Fela's fame since his death in 1997. Large record stores, what's left of them, often have whole Afrobeat sections in world music departments, and more major cities are home to local Afrobeat bands than ever before. The prime living player to thank for this is Allen, who has been in there keeping up the good work habits all along. His newest solo album is called Secret Agent, and it sounds like the most fully rounded version of Tony Allen Afrobeat he's ever made. Allen has gone through three phases in his career of more than 30 years. His first solo albums in the 70s were sturdy extensions of Fela's work. Long, long workouts without Fela's outside personality to drive them forward. In the 80s, and for a long time afterward, Allen switched to a stripped-down type of Afrobeat, influenced by dub reggae, spacey Nigerian juju, and electronica. This mode is best sampled on the fine anthology Eager Hands and Restless Feet. Now Allen has completed the circle, and Secret Agent gives us compact cuts driven by his personality, or at least his polyrhythms. Allen says in the liner notes, "Fela wrote like a singer, I write like a drummer." That's a way of saying the multilingual lyrics shouldn't be a primary concern here. But it's refreshing to hear a wider variety of voices deliver them. Listeners can decide what variety of Afrobeat they want to hear. There are groups that stick to Fela's basics without sucking the vitality out of them. One of the best of these is the French group Fenga, with particularly tangy horn charts. But if you want to delve into Afrobeat stretched out and put into a lively mix, the Washington, D.C.-based group Elika does a clever and sure-footed job on their album Ajé, Ajé.
Ajé, Ajé, here they coming again. This time I won't let them take over my place. Ajero, here they coming again. This time I won't let them take over my place. Make it well. Novia ci congisse. Amero se le moji oji wa wi. Wanwa wonga kwode. Beve va ivoa omnya fika beto. Obewa toa jagod of your heart. Ebrombe fioham le klodwa nyedeo. Aje.
There's as much reggae as Afrobeat in the music of Elika, and the folk forms of leader Massima Dogo's native country Togo play a strong role. But it is the attitude of the group, the confident way to make an American-African album that would be unimaginable without the influence of Fela. Except that, while Fela's bands always suggested a gang with a big-time bad boy leader, Elika is more like a seductive collective, forever inviting you to dance or fight the power, or both at the same time.
In the spirit,
let's march.
Let's join hands together,
let's march.
Let's move on today.
Buried and strong as the current Afrobeat scene is, no performers so far are going to take the style away from Fela Kuti. And that's good. But it would be even better if there was a sudden new star powerful enough to do it.
Milo Miles lives in Boston. He reviewed new albums by Tony Allen and Elika. You can hear the title track from Tony Allen's new album on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Melody Kramer. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. We'll close today's show with a 1976 Funkadelic recording in memory of guitarist Gary Scheider, who died last Wednesday at the age of 56. In 1997, Scheider, along with other members of George Clinton's Parliament Funkadelic, was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I'm Terry Gross.